Your funds can be put to very good use, I assure you. Again, thanks everybody for your support. Peace.
Great storytellers take listeners on astonishing journeys. I'm Hank Rubicek, producer of So What's Your Story, Thursdays at 5. Our award-winning show has brought you stories since 2008, and with your generous donations, we're going to keep it going. 713-526-5738 or kpft.org. And point to So What Your Story is one of your favorites. Extraordinary stories told by ordinary people only on KPFT Houston's Community Radio.
Your Story, the only program originating in Houston devoted to storytelling. We are aired only on Houston's community station, KPFT 90.1 FM, here in Houston, or kpft.org on the internet. I'm Mary Edgerton, tonight's host, and along with the best team on radio, we celebrate the power of story by placing the spotlight on tellers whose stories take us on journeys through the windows of their souls, on fanciful trips amid worlds of enchantment, before finally returning us safely to the present. Now, when I host these shows, I try to identify a theme that usually has something to do with the month. Today, I'm actually going to focus on the day. Do you know whose birthday is today? Thursday, August 18th, was when Patrick Swayze was born. You know, he was always near and dear to our hearts, being one of our own from Houston. Terrific dancer and actor, and of course, gone way too soon. But on the topic of birthdays, I have a fantastic and fascinating storyteller for you to tell us about her first celebration of her birthday in the U.S. Let me introduce Marie Denise, our guest tonight. Marie Denise has lived in 3 countries and 8 states working in social services. But before I go any further, Marie, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Mary. I'm so excited to be here.
Oh, and can you please share with us that wonderful story about your first birthday celebration in the U.S.?
I'd love to. So the story begins that I was born in Haiti. And in the early 70s, both my parents died during my infancy, between my infancy and toddler years, of tuberculosis, as it was a pandemic or an endemic at that time. And I myself was really sick with tuberculosis and was malnourished. And I was like so sick and malnourished that I look like one of those babies on Save the Children or Feed the Children on TV, you see. And I was given to, quote unquote, an aunt. Now, you know, for Black folks, when we say aunt or uncle and it's something, it doesn't necessarily mean that they're relatives or blood related, but maybe somebody of a term of endearment. So I don't know if this was an actual relative. But nonetheless, I was given to this person who tried to take care of me for a while, but obviously being so sick myself, she decided that I probably needed to get to a hospital. So she traveled to the capital of Haiti, Port-au-Prince, and brought me to a hospital that was for children who had tuberculosis. And she only left my name and my possible last name in the village I was born. Otherwise, there's no other documentation. And she never ended up coming back for me. So we don't know why, you know, either because she had other mouths to feed, or maybe she got sick with tuberculosis and passed away, or maybe because she thought that I was just so sickly that I was probably going to die anyway. And she lived about 12 hours one way from the hospital. So I could understand why she may not have been able to come back for whatever reason. And but she left no documentation. And maybe there was no documentation. So nobody really knows how old I was when I came in. And being so sick and malnourished, I've been told that when I came in, I looked like I was probably only maybe 9 months old. But I had enough teeth that they knew that I could have been a little bit older. And so I ended up living in the hospital. And spoiler alert, I didn't die. And so in the meantime, there was a young American couple who came to Haiti to tour all the different mission sites that the United Methodist denomination had throughout Haiti. And they ended up at my hospital, which was Grace Children's Hospital, that happened to be one of the mission sites. And when they came, around that time, they found out that they couldn't bear children of their own. So the woman just decided she wanted a baby, and she didn't care where in the world it came from. And so she said, you know, she decided that she wanted to see what kind of babies there were in Haiti. So she went to the director of the hospital at that time, and she was like, "Hey, do you have any abandoned babies I can take home?" And the director said, "Oh, there's plenty. Come out the next day and just pick one out." And exactly that's what she did. And so this couple came back the next day, and they approached the first nurse they saw. And that nurse happened to be getting a little girl dressed. And when she asked, the nurse said, "You know, well, she's available. Do you want her?" And they took a look, and they're like, "Sure." And that little girl happened to be me. And so so this American couple thought that at the end of the month, after they were done touring these different mission sites, that they were going to be able to sweep me in their arms and sweep me to America. Well, that's not quite how it happened, Mary, because I had no documentation. The only way that they knew I was alive is because they were looking at me. So they went back to America, and they started the adoption process, which took 3 long years. Well, in the meantime, between time, here I am, 2, 3, maybe years old, running around the hospital healthy. And the hospital knew that I couldn't stay there because they were worried about me being reinfected. But from my understanding is that the staff and the director all fell in love with me, and they just could not bear to send me to an orphanage in Haiti. Most likely because in Haiti, when you're adopted by other Haitian families, you don't really become part of the family. You're more of like a child servant that you can stay in that position for the remainder of your life or until you move on somehow. And so that's part of the reason why they also didn't want to send me. So they knew that I couldn't stay there. Well, it just so happened that there was another American family who were actual missionaries in Haiti through the International Child Care, ICC. And the mother was a volunteer at Grace Children's Hospital, the hospital I was at. So she had actually gotten to know me. And they decided that she decided that she would take me home to the family as long as this American couple would go through with the adoption. And so I came home with her, and my adoption process got underway. Well, the first order of business is they had to, you know, give me a birthday. So my missionary mom, she gave me her birthday, and that's how I celebrated November 2nd. I'm not really a true Scorpio after all these years, but I accept that anyway. And so in that process, then, you know, my missionary mom became so instrumental as the boots on the ground. She went through, you know, got the attorneys, and she had to navigate, you know, the lack of infrastructure and governmental structures in Haiti to try to get through all this process, putting together all my documentation. They had to create a birth certificate for me, and all of that. Especially because she knew Haiti, she knew Creole, the language. So yeah, I lived with this family for 3 years. Well, finally, 3 years comes up and my adoption process is almost complete. And then they realize, well, heck, we need to decide how old she is. And so they go and they say, well, how old do you want her to be? Right? So they reach out to my soon to be adoptive parents in America, and you know, they said, well, what age do you want her to be? And they looked at pictures and they looked at my teeth and whatever, and they were like, well, maybe 5. So they're like, all right. So on the adoption papers, they put on there that I was going to be turning 5 November 2nd. However, because I was getting ready to come to America as the final thing, they were like, well, you know, in a few months after she reaches America, she's going to be having a birthday. So we'll go ahead and put that she is 6 years old coming into America. Well, they messed up, Mary, and they actually put 7. And they're like, oh, shoot, instead of putting 6, we put 7. Do you want us to go and change it? And everybody involved was like, is it going to take another 3 years? And they're like, you know, forget it. Don't worry about it. We'll deal with it when she gets here. So I enter America at age 5 and showed up about at the end of May. Matter of fact, May 28, 1982. And a couple months later, I start kindergarten. So I start kindergarten at age 5. A couple months later after that, my first birthday in America, November 2nd. And of course, it's a celebration. So my mom makes up the cupcakes and I bring them to class to share with my classmates. And you know how the kids stand up and sing you happy birthday to you. And then, you know, they get to that dreaded verse that says, you know, how old are you? But at that age, we're proud to say how old we are. So I stand up, pump up my chest, and I scream at the top of my lungs, I'm 7 years old. And everybody's like, wait, what? No, how could you be 7? You were just 5 yesterday. So my teacher comes, she says, no, sweetie, you are 6 years old today. And I said, nope, I'm 7. And she said, no, after 5 comes 6, so you're 6 years old today. Yep, I know, but I'm 7. And she decides, you know what, I'm not going to argue with you. I'm just going to send a note home. So she scribbles out a note, she sends it home and says to my parents, look, your kid probably needs some math tutoring because she doesn't seem to understand the concept of counting. And so that is how I became 7 years old. And I got deprived of my 6 year worth of life. So I've never been 6 years old.
Just skip that year. Just jump over.
Yeah.
Well, how are you going to compensate for that?
I know, right? So I know this isn't going to sound so crazy, but over the years, I have really felt like, I feel like I should make up for that. So I've been thinking about and toying with the idea of throwing myself a 6-year-old birthday party with an adult theme. I think that would be fun, like a piñata filled with, you know, adult beverages, little bottles of beverages, and adult gifts.
Put me on your invitation list.
Absolutely.
I'll celebrate your 6th birthday with you. Oh, that was a great story. Gosh, you've been through so much. And your beginning story really fascinates me. You know, having come from the village, the woman taking care of you, traveling for 12 hours to get to Port-au-Prince. Were you ever able to find out who your biological family was?
Well, I got a story for that too.
Okay.
So, yes, I've had this longing, of course, all my life just to know, you know, my roots. Whose shoulders do I stand upon? You know, whose blood runs through my veins? And so I'm going to fast forward to when I was an undergrad in living in Atlanta, Georgia. And my boyfriend at that time had this amazing knack for walking up to people and just picking out who they felt that they could be friends with or had some kind of resource or something. And he walked up, and anybody who was black and had an accent, he would definitely target them. So he met this guy who had an accent and asked him who he is, and come to find out that the guy happened to be Haitian. And so my boyfriend at the time tells him my story that I just told you, and that guy decided that he was going to take my mission, take my search and my family on as his own personal mission to find my family. So I'm like, yes. So he comes to me and he says, why don't you write out your story in letter form and make copies of different pictures throughout the different stages of your life? Because you know how you can sometimes look at like different people in your family at different stages of your life. So I make about, you know, seven or more copies of different pictures, and I send it to him. And his plan was for him to send out seven letters throughout the seven major churches in Haiti. Prominently because in Haiti, of course, there's a really poor infrastructure, so record keeping isn't the greatest. A lot of people don't have births in hospitals. I may not have been born in a hospital. And then back then, we don't know where records might have been kept, or sometimes people have keep records through churches, because a lot of times churches will keep records of births. So he was going to send them to like churches like the Catholic Church and the Presbyterian Church, the United Methodist Church, and others. So he sends these letters out, and we wait, and we wait, and we wait. Months go by, and nothing. And so after a while, of course, my heart sinks, and I'm just thinking, okay, another dead end. And after a while, it's taken so long that I kind of forget about it, and I move on with life. So at the time in Atlanta, I was working on my undergrad, and I was working at a homeless nonprofit organization that had this deteriorating building, was kind of in shambles, and we just worked with anybody who came in that was homeless. And I'm in my office one day, maybe about a year after all of this, and I get a phone call, and I answer the phone, and a stranger on the other end says, hi, I'm looking for, and Mary, he says my whole name, including my Haitian surname. I'm shocked. I froze, because nobody knows my whole full name, including my surname, except for maybe, what, four or five people in the United States? And, of course, who's this perfect man on the phone that I don't know? And so I'm just, like, shocked. And he says, hello? And I said, yeah. Who is this? And he introduced himself, saying that he is one of the new directors of Grace Children's Hospital, the hospital I was abandoned at. And he said, we received one of your letters, and I read it, and I was so enthralled that I had to read it to the whole staff at Grace Children's Hospital. And he says that while he was reading it, he found out that there's still quite a few staff who were staff when I was in Grace Children's Hospital years ago, and that they remembered me. And he said while he was reading it, everybody started crying. He said there wasn't a dry eye. And of course they decided, oh, absolutely, they wanted to see if they could find any records for me. And then he started crying, and he was crying, and I'm just holding on like, what? And so I start crying because he's crying. And he finally pulls himself together, and he says, I want to just so apologize, because we went back and we looked for those records. But in the late 80s, early 90s, the hospital had caught on fire and burned all those records from at least 80-something until back. And therefore, another piece of my history was gone. And that's all he could do for me. So Mary, no. I've never been able to find my family yet, and I still yearn for it so dearly.
So that makes me want to cry. Yeah.
Yeah. But, you know, I still have hope.
Yes. Maybe you should try one of those 23andMe or Ancestry.com gene sequencing products to see if you have relatives. I know it would be in the United States.
Right.
But maybe there's somebody, a third, fourth, fifth cousin who's... migrated.
Exactly.
To the U.S.
You know, you're not the first person who said that, and I don't know why I'm dragging my feet, because a lot of people have asked me if I've done that 23andMe or Ancestry.com, and maybe just me being cynical, or maybe I need to stop, but I'm kind of cynical because I know that, to my understanding, is in order for families to find each other, people have to put their DNA in there, right? So the DNA pool grows. And I'm thinking that Haiti has, you know, doesn't have that kind of infrastructure. So how many Haitians are really putting their DNA in there? However, to be fair, I do know there's a lot of Haitians in America that could have put that in there, or maybe I just need to put it in there. Who knows what's what will come up. So yes, I plan to do that.
Well, let's see what happens.
Yeah.
The story will continue. You may come back as a guest and have another part of it.
Oh, we'll be celebrating.
Yes. So it's obvious you have really strong ties to Haiti. So did you actually become a U.S. citizen as a part of this adoption process?
Well, I have another story for that, too.
All right. It's a storytelling show.
Oh, goodness. So fast forward, we'll go back first to my adoption process. So at that time in the 80s, that I don't know if you were able to become a U.S. citizen through adoption right away. I think there was an extra step that once the adoption process was finished, then the parents would do the one last step to make you an official U.S. citizen. I don't think it's that way any longer. However, by the time I got to the U.S., my parents were just exhausted, my adoptive parents. They had spent tons of money, 3 years, and all the drama in between to try to get me here. So by the time I got to America, I think they just were like, you know what? You're here. So no, they didn't do that final step of making sure that I was a U.S. citizen. So my whole life, I've been told that I am still a Haitian citizen. Partly because they didn't go through the American embassy or consulate to do my adoption. Instead, they went through the Haitian embassy or a consulate to do my adoption, which maybe that might have also been why they had to do that extra step that they didn't do. Regardless, I've been walking around proudly with my Haitian citizenship all these years. However, you know, there's been different times in my life that I've tried to get jobs that required for me to be a U.S. citizen. For instance, right after graduating with my bachelor's in social work, I really wanted to be a federal probation officer. And so I applied, I got the interview, passed the interview state. The next state was, or a portion was, for me to do the test. So I went and did the written test and passed it with a high 90s. Then the next step would be for you to do like an agility test. And I got to that step and finally somebody asked me, you know, are you a U.S. citizen? And I couldn't lie. And so I was like, no, I'm still on a green card. And that's where the interview stopped. And they said, I'm sorry, you have to be a U.S. citizen in order to carry a gun. And for the job, you have to carry a gun. So I wasn't able to continue. So, of course, I was kind of heartbroken, but not enough to give up my Haitian citizenship. So I moved on. And then years later, I get married and but before I got married, I had found out about the Peace Corps somewhere in late high school, early college, and I absolutely loved Peace Corps. And I said, whatever I got to do, I'm going to go be a Peace Corps volunteer. So, of course, years later, I'm married now, and I still have this burning desire to be a Peace Corps volunteer. So I asked my husband at that time, and I said, hey, would you be willing? And he said, yes. So, of course, we start the process, and part of the requirement of being a Peace Corps volunteer is that you have to be a U.S. citizen. And so I was faced again with that dilemma of, okay, am I going to give up my Haitian citizenship? I wanted it so badly, plus all these other barriers that it kind of prevents me from being able to do certain things. I decided with a heavy heart that, yes, I would give up my Haitian citizenship. So started the process. And put in my head. So different people were giving me different advice of how to go about this. Some people said that I should be able to put in my citizenship application based on my generality of being here forever, being married to an American citizen, or put it in as my parents who adopted me, but that was so many years ago. So, and some other crazy advice. So I went and took it upon myself to do it as a general thing because I've been here for 100 years. I'm married. And, you know, that at that time, it cost, what, between $400 or $500, which granted, that's not a lot, but for a young couple starting out in life, college, you know, just getting out of college, yeah, that was kind of a lot at that time. So I put that in and got the little notification that it was accepted and that it was starting the process. And you can, they have it on the website that you can watch where it is during throughout the processes. A couple months go by, nothing. No movement. And I'm like, okay, what's going on? And reach out to them. And of course, they don't want to answer the phone. So I hop in my car at the time, my husband at that time, and I were living in Birmingham, which was about 2 hours from Atlanta. So I hop in the car, I go to the immigration office, and I'm like, hey, you know, what's going on? And they're like, you know, oh, we're processing it. Okay, so a couple months passes again and still nothing, no movement. Hop in my car, go back down to the IMS, and they were like, oh, well, you put in the wrong paperwork. You should have put it in for you being adopted. So I put in the application. That's like another $500 to $600, right? So this is becoming expensive and time consuming. However, time passes, nothing, no movement. And I'm just like tearing out my mind because I'm like, wait a minute. Our process for the Peace Corps is coming along, and at some point in time, they're going to want to show, you know, I have proof that I'm a legal citizen. So, so I go down there again at some point in time, and finally, I'm hot. I'm ticked off because this is not going almost a year, and I've not heard anything. No movement. I storm down there, and I'm demanding. I'm not leaving until somebody gives me some answers, right? And the IMS officer says, well, hold on for a moment. And they go in the back, and they leave me out in the lobby for, seems like forever. They come back, and they have a file. And they open the file, and they're looking at this document, and they're looking at me, they're looking at the document, and they finally say, are you? And they name another person. And I said, no, I am Marie Denise. And they're like, oh, are you sure you're not? And I said, no, I'm not that person. And they're like, huh, okay, it looks like we've lost a lot of your paperwork, and a little bit that we have has been mixed with this other person. Mary, they combined some of my documents with a whole nother person. And I'm like, what?
An amalgamation. Oh, my God. And are you cursed to have your documents be messed up, lost, burnt?
I don't know. Either I'm jinxed or I'm supposed to have this crazy journey.
And it's amazing that the immigration department would do that, that they would actually mix up two people together.
Well, I don't know who handles. That's the thing. I don't know how all the government works. So whoever did it from years ago, because we're talking about, what, 1982 when these documents came, holding it all the way until 2007. So I don't know if it's immigration who, but somebody in the government done messed up.
Yes. I mean, I know I had an issue in banking. I was consolidating my student loans.
Mm-hmm.
So I think I had two or three different agencies, I guess two, and I decided to consolidate them into one. And what they do is they take out a loan in your name, mm-hmm. and they pay off the older loans,
mm-hmm.
the two of them, and then you start paying off the new loan.
Right.
And I keep getting these bills from one of these older loans. And I'm saying, well, why? I'm paying off on this new loan now, and wasn't this consolidated? I mean, I actually paid it a couple of times thinking, well, okay, maybe this was just something left over. But I called one night, and it was after the work day when I had time to talk to somebody. Well, it turns out that they had used some of that money to pay off somebody else's loans. Like, and I'm like, no, 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 no. I'm not his sugar mama. That money back.
Right.
And of course, this is like 8 o'clock at night, you know, and nobody's in their offices. I was a little freaked out, but we did get it cleared up. But
yeah,
there are these sometimes these mix-ups.
Exactly.
I became Elmer. That was is the person's name.
Okay.
Okay, we're going to have more to come in a minute, but now let's pause for station identification. We are a community-based storytelling radio show broadcast at KPFT 90.1 FM, Houston Community Radio, also broadcast at 91.9 in Huntsville and 89.5 in Galveston. Don't forget, you can find us anywhere on the internet. Live streaming is kpft.org. Our show, So What's Your Story, is broadcast every Thursday at 5 Central Time. But as you will hear, you can listen to the show after it has been aired. Yes, you just visit our sponsor, the Houston Storytellers Guild, at houstonstorytellers.org, where you can replay any of our previous shows from So What's Your Story by selecting the So What's Your Story radio show tab. And that was Houston Storytellers. It's plural, and there are no spaces. Want to become a storyteller? Well, you can join the Houston Storytellers Guild and attend their monthly story swap on the fourth Tuesday of the month. Check out their calendar tab and grab the Zoom information for the next virtual swap, which is coming up on Tuesday, August 23rd. The theme will be Dog Days. I know that theme well. I've used it myself before on KPFT on So What's Your Story? Yes, August is hot. You can also find some other exciting events on the calendar, such as the next meeting of the San Antonio Storytelling Association. And another way to get into storytelling is by joining the Texas Storytelling Association and the National Storytelling Network. You can find them at TejasStorytelling.com. So that one might be a little more challenging. Let me spell it out. TejasStorytelling.com. Our friends at The Moth are back at Warehouse Live in person and back on schedule for the second Tuesday of the month. The next show is September 13th with the theme Juggle. Check out their Facebook page, The Moth in Houston, for updates on their next storytelling slam. And speaking of Facebook, you can find us at So What's Your Story on Facebook. Please visit us, and yes, please like us. You can also suggest storytellers or themes on Facebook, or by emailing us at swys@kpft.org. All right, let's curl up, get comfortable, and travel to Storyland again with Marie. So Marie, did you ever become a citizen? Or did you become an amalgamated citizen with somebody else?
Well, let me finish telling you the story. A little bit more with that. So after I found out that they had mixed my few documents they had with this other person, and I had to confirm that, no, I'm not that other person, they were like, okay, give us a moment. And they went back into the office somewhere, and they left me back. And finally, they were like, yeah, let us work on it. So I leave, and a couple months go by, and still nothing. I go back up there, drive back up to the IMS, and again, they're like, we're working on it. So by this time, we're looking at basically almost a year and a half into this process, and I'm like almost pulling out my hair because Peace Corps is going to call any moment to invite us to go serve. And finally, I'm telling, you know, all these people, and finally somebody advises me, well, why don't you get your state representative involved? So I look up my state representative, reach out to that person. Now, I don't know if it was the actual state representative or one of their representatives, but it was a woman who calls, and I tell them my story, and they're like, my goodness, yeah, let me get on that. And they take it on as their personal mission that they're going to find out what's going on with the citizenship. And so they, you know, she promised me she'll get back with me. 2 weeks passes. She calls and she says, yeah, it looks like they mixed your documents with somebody else. And I'm like, yep, I know that already. And they're like, okay, well, we're working on it. Well, a couple more months passes and nothing. I'm not hearing back from this person. And every time I'm calling, they're like, yeah, we're working on it. We're working on it. And I'm pulling out my hair some more. And I'm just like, you know, starting to get panicky. And there's nothing. Every time I call, they're always saying they're just working on it. So I get some more advice and somebody says, you know what? You know, it's now almost what? More than 18 months in. And they say, you know what? Why don't you get an immigration attorney to help you fight this? Yes. So after all these, you know, now over $1,000 and all this travel back and forth from Birmingham to Atlanta, gas money, time off from work, I finally say, yeah, nuts to it. I'm getting an immigration attorney. And I retained one for $1,500. And my attorney says, well, why don't you go ahead and call your state representative and let them know that you've retained me and that you give them permission to speak to me. So I go and I call the state representative. This was on a Wednesday. And I'm sorry, this was on a Tuesday. And get a hold of her and I explain to her what my attorney says and that I have one. And she goes ballistics. And Mary, she starts yelling at me and she drops the F-bomb. And she's so angry, like, how dare I go and get this attorney? She said she was going to handle it and this and that and the third. And she hangs up on me. And I'm shocked. And I was like, whoa. So I, you know, go back and I tell my attorney. So this happened on Tuesday. Wednesday evening, I get this call from my representative, from that representative, as if we were like best friends and nothing happened. She's like, hey, how you doing, Marie? I'm kind of confused. And I'm like, I'm doing okay. She said, yeah, isn't this fantastic news? And I'm asking her what, I don't know what news is this. She said, well, you're swearing. You're getting sworn in on Friday. And I said, oh, I didn't know that. She said, well, how did you not know? Didn't you get the letter? Letter? What letter are you talking about? She said, oh, well, I got the letter. Well, let me fax it to you. I said, okay. So she faxed it to me back in the day when we were faxing. And I get this, and sure enough, it's a letter that states that I'm going to get sworn in Friday. This is late Wednesday night. On Friday at like, and I have to be in Atlanta at like 7 something in the morning. I'm like, oh, okay. So I throw myself together. I run to Atlanta on Friday morning. And I get there, and there's this a sea of kids, about 70-some people, who are all getting sworn in at the same time I am. And I think it was only me and one other adult who looked like he was probably about 80 who was getting sworn in, who was getting sworn in that day. So they make us get in line, and they're and at the window at the IMS, they're having parents sign documents or whatever it is, and I'm not sure what they're signing. So finally they get to me and they're like, okay, who are you? And I said, I'm here to get sworn in. My name is Marie Denise. And they look and they look at the computer and they're like, you're supposed to be getting sworn in today? And I said, yeah. They're like, give us a moment. So they go in the back, they come back and they're like, who told you that you're getting sworn in today? And I said, oh, and so I thank heavens I was smart enough to bring the letter and I show them the letter. And they're like, oh, give us a moment. So they come back and they're like, okay, yeah, why don't you sit over there? And they point to some chairs and we'll get right with you. I go and sit. They finish processing everybody else. Finally, it's time for the swearing ceremony. So they tell me, well, go ahead and just get sworn in. Or they don't call me. So I'm just sitting there and I finally go up to the counter and I'm like, no one called me to do whatever this paperwork is. And they're like, oh, don't worry about it. We need to actually take a picture for your certification. Why don't you come around the back and we'll take a picture. So they take a picture for the it's like a visa size picture. And then they're like, so go ahead and get sworn in. And afterwards, we'll make sure that you get your certification. So with a heavy heart, I get sworn in, and I'm like in turmoil because I've never wanted to give up my Haitian citizenship, you know, and after 30-some years of having it, you know, it's kind of like this sad thing. And so I start crying kind of to myself as we're getting sworn in, and everybody else is applauding and happy and excited, and I'm kind of just sitting there crying. And then so then after the ceremony, they have you go back up to the counter to do whatever your last paperwork is, and so they call you one by one. Everybody gets called, and I'm still sitting there. So I finally go up to the counter. I'm like, hey, no one called me. They're like, oh, you know, give us a moment. We're still processing some of your paperwork. So I go and sit down. Finally, towards the end of the day, they hand me my certification, Mary. And I have it here with me today. And it is amazing as I'm looking at it. It says it's time-stamped that I that it was time-stamped June 29th, 2007, but it reads, Marie Denise is now a citizen of the United States of America, became a citizen thereof on May 28, 1982.
That was the day you came to America.
So Mary, supposedly I've been a U.S. citizen the whole time I've been in America, but there's been no documentation.
You are jinxed. There's no doubt about it. You are jinxed.
Or blessed, maybe. We'll say blessed rather than jinxed. You know, so yeah, it was amazing. So I just kind of sat there with my jaw dropped. Like, I've been carrying around a green card all my life. Didn't get that job that I wanted because I thought, you know, I was not a U.S. citizen.
Right.
And lo and behold, I've been one ever since. So I don't know if maybe they, you know, grandfathered me back in. Because after a while, when you do international adoptions, at least through the U.S. Embassy, you know, U.S., you are automatically a U.S. citizen. And so I don't know if they, you know, grandfathered me back in, or maybe that representative, after she cussed me out, probably called them and like, look, she's about to sue the government. Do this. Right?
Yes.
I don't know. So, yes, I am officially a U.S. citizen, and I'm a paper-carrying member.
All right. Congratulations. Thank goodness you were finally able to do that. It's such an ordeal. And like I mentioned before, when you find yourself combined with somebody else, trying to extricate yourself is something. I have to say that person from the state representative's office sounds a bit on the unprofessional side.
I think I scared them because the government doesn't want to be sued.
Yeah.
But I didn't get that money back, so none of it.
Yeah. That's a shame, really. Well, let's go back to when you were a little girl, because you did become a citizen.
Yes.
Back then. And it must have been quite a journey to come from Port-au-Prince to Michigan. I mean, there's a huge change.
Yeah, definitely different as night and day in North and South.
What's a special experience that stands out to you?
Oh, goodness. I had so many, but I think one of the funniest ones was my first Christmas in America. So kind of going back to when I was still in Haiti with my missionary family, who were Americans and they had been growing up in the South, you know, they're from the South, but they know snow. And so this family, my missionary family, started preparing me for life in America and life in Michigan specifically, stating, you know, telling me stories about snow and how there was this white stuff that was going to fall from the sky and it was going to blanket all, you know, on outside. And it was so fun to be in. It's going to fall around Christmas time and you can go outside and you can play in it and you can make a snowman, which to my Haitian mind, I don't know what a snowman is, but okay. You know, I could do snow angels and it's just so beautiful. You can have so much fun. And it definitely comes around Christmas time and such a special time of the year. And so all I knew is this, when I get to America with this other family, you know, I'm going to have this fabulous, wonderful white stuff I'm going to play in. So I come to the U.S., like I said, at the end of May. The fall comes and they start putting sweaters and coats and, you know, first time probably ever for me to wear a coat. And then, you know, a winter coat. And no snow. It was cold, but no snow. And I'm waiting for snow. And starts the holiday season starts to come. And everybody starts talking about Christmas. And the decorations come up. And I'm still seeing no snow. And finally Christmas comes around. And I'm like, okay, this snow, you know, this white stuff is going to be falling from the sky any minute. And we wake up on Christmas. And Mary, it is 70 degrees.
Are you sure you weren't in Houston?
Just a fluke of a year. Yeah, it was warm, and there's even a picture of me in a little sweater, and I'm playing with some pine needles or pine branches doing something, and I'm just smiling, and it's warm, and it's sunny on Christmas Day. So I was like, wait a minute, they lied to me. Where's the snow? Where's the snow? And so we went through the Christmas holiday with no snow. And that was pretty much a fluke. Well, then January comes along and wake up one day and sure enough, this white stuff had covered all the outside. I'm just so excited, like, oh, this is the white stuff they talked about. So my mom, dresses me up in all the snow stuff and she sends us outside. And I get outside, Mary, and I touch this white stuff and I freeze. And I'm like, wait a minute, this is cold. And I hate it. And I'm like, wait a minute, they lied. This isn't fun. They didn't tell me it was cold and wet and heavy. And so anyway, yeah, that was my first experience with Christmas and with snow.
Well, I did grow up in Texas, and I have to say that I always felt like I was cheated because we'd be playing all this let it snow, right? Let it snow music and wishing for a white Christmas. And you know, in Rio Grande City, Texas, actually 70 degrees might be a little cool
right.
for a typical Christmas, but there was no snow.
And oh, boy.
Someone even told me one time, well, think of it as more like the original Christmas in Palestine. It doesn't snow there, but that's no comfort to a little kid.
No, no. But, you know, I'd be okay with snow on Christmas and then no snow the rest of the time. So we can have that white Christmas.
Oh, you didn't fall in love with snow? No.
No, that's probably why I found my way to Houston eventually.
Yeah, I can see that. Yes, where we publish picture books for the living room table of snow in Houston because it happens so rarely.
Oh, wow. Well, you're not missing too much, but it is pretty for Christmas.
Yes. Well, Marie, thank you so much for coming and sharing all these wonderful stories with us. And you're such an enthusiastic storyteller. It's great to be around you and hear them. To our listeners out there, we will be back next week with more tellers and new journeys. And don't move that dial. Stay tuned in to KPFT because Charles Hightower's R&B Gold is up next with a soothing mix of music as a balm for your soul. Make Houston's community station, KPFT 90.1, a part of every day. And while you're driving home or just chilling, join us every Thursday at 5 p.m. for So What's Your Story? It's a great way to make the commute go by. Keep loving great stories, and we'll keep bringing them to you. This is Mary Edgerton, and along with the rest of the So What's Your Story team, we never want you to forget that even if a story doesn't end the way you want, it's never too late to live happily ever after. Peace. And I want to say that I have a special piece of music just for that missing 6th birthday of yours, Marie.
Oh, thank you.
What could be more perfectly than to have a world party on the day you came to be? Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday. I just never understood how a man who died for good not have a David Wood.
dream that you had so long ago that lives in all of the hearts of people. We'll make the dream become a reality. I know we will, because our hearts tell us so.
And now, after that wonderful show, let me remind you that life repeats itself sometimes, especially when it comes to KPFT fund drives. Not only are we in a fund drive, but it has been extended to August 20th. So here we are at So What's Your Story, once again asking you to help keep KPFT Houston Community Radio on the air and to keep our storytelling radio show alive. Please call 713-526-5738 with your generous donation, or go to kpft.org, press the donations button, and then please select So What's Your Story as one of the programs you love. So What's Your Story brought storytelling to Houston in 2008. We have become an institution and part of the cultural landscape in this diverse city. Help us stay afloat by telling the station and Pacifica that storytelling, the kind of extraordinary stories told by ordinary people, should always be a part of our lives. In other words, please give us another birthday. Thank you.
Adopt US Kids presents What to Expect When You're Expecting a Teenager, Learning the Lingo.
Today I'm going to help parents translate teen slang. Now, when a teen says something is on fleek, it's exactly like saying, that's rad. It simply means that something is awesome or cool. Another one is totes. It's exactly like saying totally, just shorter. As in, I totes love going to the mall with Becca. Another word you might hear is jelly. Jelly is a shorter, better way to say jealous. As in, Chloe, I am like so jelly of your unicorn phone case.
You don't have to speak teen to be a perfect parent. Thousands of teens in foster care will think you're, rad, just the same. To learn more, visit AdoptUSKids.org. A public service announcement brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, AdoptUSKids, and the Ad Council.
Hi, my name is Robin Lewis, and I work in the membership department at KPFT. And I'd like to talk to you about how much you listen. You're already a KPFT listener, so should you become a member? One way to decide is to think about how much you listen. Maybe you listen to kpft.org at work or check the site when there's breaking news or to download your favorite shows. Through the week, you catch some of Progressive Forum or Democracy Now!, Tom Hartman or Pan-African Journal, or Facets. See, you do listen enough to give. You spend a lot of time listening to KPFT, and that makes it worthy of your financial support right now. Please support programs you love on weekends and all week long by making a contribution now. Give online at kpft.org or call 713-526-5738 and talk to a volunteer who would love to talk to you about how much you value KPFT.
What's happening, KPFTers? This is Jeff Plankenhorn. From my years of traveling the road with Texas artists, backing them up, to my rise to solo artist recording and touring all over this wonderful world of ours, I know just how important public radio is. And real DJs who have the freedom to play the music of independent artists like me and my friends, mentors, and musical cohorts, curated specifically for their listeners. KPFT is undoubtedly one of those very special stations. That's why I am hoping you'll support KPFT with your donation in any amount. Call 713-526-5738 or donate online at kpft.org. Help keep independent radio on the air and going strong on KPFT Houston.
Life in Houston is filled with options. You could do something different every night for a year and never run out of music, theater, films, or restaurants. How to decide? We can help. KPFT is a rich resource for community, culture, and cuisine. Son Pacifica keeps you current on the latest Latino films, theater, restaurants, and books. Howlin' the Blues connects you to the city's live music scene. And our weekly Living Art broadcast features local artists and events you might not discover otherwise. These are just a few of the many programs that will help you make the most of your city, even on nights when you're staying in. And small donations from listeners like you make it all possible. Become a member today. Call us or text GIVE to 713-526-5738 or go to kpft.org and hit the donate button. We're Houston's community station, 90.1 KPFT.